Among Missouri's loyalists, morale plummeted. In late August, realizing he must act before the situation deteriorated further, Fremont issued a bold proclamation. Without consulting Lincoln, he declared martial law throughout the state, giving the military the authority to try and, if warranted, shoot any rebels within Union lines who were found with arms in their hands. Union troops were directed to confiscate all property, including slaves, of all persons who shall be directly proven to have taken an active part with their enemies in the field. These slaves, Fremont proclaimed, are hereby declared freemen. Fremont's policy far exceeded the Confiscation Act passed by the Congress earlier that month, which applied only to slaves supporting Confederate troops and did not spell out their future status. Lincoln learned of Fremont's proclamation by reading it in the newspapers along with the rest of the nation. With this announcement, Fremont had unilaterally recast the struggle to preserve the Union as a war against slavery, a shift that the president believed would lead Kentucky and the border states to join the Confederacy. Lincoln wrote a private letter to Fremont, expressing his anxiety on two points. First, should you shoot a man according to the proclamation, the Confederates would very certainly shoot our best man in their hands in retaliation. And so, man for man, indefinitely. Even more troubling, he saw great danger in liberating slaves of traitorous owners, a move that would certainly alarm our Southern Union friends and turn them against us, perhaps ruin our rather fair prospect for Kentucky. Allow me, therefore, to ask that you will, as of your own motion, modify that paragraph so as to conform to the recent Confiscation Act of Congress. Lincoln was anxious that Fremont change the language of his own accord so that the president would not be officially forced to override him. He understood that if the controversy became public, radical Republicans, whose loyalty was crucial to his governing coalition, might side with Fremont rather than with him. Moreover, as Lincoln later explained to Orville Browning, Fremont's proclamation as to confiscation of property and the liberation of slaves is purely political and not within the range of military law or necessity. As chief executive, he could not allow a general in the field to determine the permanent future condition of slaves. Seward fully supported Lincoln on principle as well as policy. The trouble with Fremont was that he acted without authority from the president, Seward later maintained. The president could permit no subordinate to assume a responsibility which belonged only to himself. Lincoln's fears about the reaction to Fremont's proclamation in the border states were justified. Within days, frantic letters reached Washington from Unionists in Kentucky. Joshua Speed wrote to Lincoln that Fremont's proclamation had left him unable to eat or sleep. It will crush out every vestige of a Union party in the state. I, perhaps, and a few others will be left alone. He reminded his old friend that there were from 180 to 200,000 slaves in Kentucky, of whom only 20,000 belonged to rebels. So fixed is public sentiment in this state against freeing Negroes and allowing Negroes to be emancipated and remain among us, he continued, that you had as well attack the freedom of worship in the North, or the right of a parent to teach his child to read, as to wage war in a slave state on such a principle. Meanwhile, events in Missouri took a strange turn. On September 1st, the same day that Fremont made his proclamation public, Colonel Frank Blair penned a long letter to his brother Montgomery that would lead to the colonel's arrest and imprisonment 2 weeks later. "I know that you and I are both in some sort responsible for Fremont's appointment," he admitted, "but my decided opinion is that he should be relieved of his command." Blair was not reacting to the proclamation, as was assumed by contemporaries and historians alike. On the contrary, he told Monty he agreed with the proclamation, believing that stringent measures, including the liberation of slaves, were necessary to dispel the illusions of impunity the marauding band of rebel guerrillas seemed to harbor. He wished only that the proclamation had been issued earlier, when Fremont had the power to enforce it, and the enemy no power to retaliate. But since Fremont had taken command, Frank told his brother, the situation in Missouri had grown increasingly desperate. Through gross and inexcusable negligence, the rebels had accumulated a substantial following. "Oh, for 1 hour of our dead lion," he lamented, adding that many now ascribed Lyon's death to Fremont's failure to reinforce him. Moreover, in the camps around St. Louis, there was an active want of discipline, reminiscent of the disorganization in Washington that led to Bull Run. If his brother had information absolving Fremont, Frank continued, if the government knew more of Fremont's plans than he, then Montgomery should burn this paper and say that I am an alarmist. But at this moment his faith was shaken to the very foundations. Monty Blair showed his brother's frank letter to Lincoln, and added a letter of his own. He asserted that he himself had reluctantly concluded that Fremont must be dismissed. He acknowledged that he had sponsored Fremont at the start, having enjoyed a warm friendship with the celebrated explorer. But being now satisfied of my mistake, duty requires that I should frankly admit it, and ask that it may be promptly corrected. Like Frank, he took no issue with the proclamation, believing a show of strength was necessary. Fremont's removal, he concluded, was required by public interests. Hearing similar testimony from other sources in Missouri, Lincoln sent General Meigs and Montgomery Blair on September 10th to talk with Fremont and look into the affair. At this point, the president still had not received confirmation from Fremont that he would modify the proclamation as requested. That evening, Fremont's spirited wife, Jessie, the daughter of former Senator Thomas Benton, arrived in Washington after a 3-day trip on a dusty, cramped train to hand-deliver Fremont's delayed response. She sent Lincoln a card asking when she could see him, and received the peremptory response, "A. Lincoln, now." Straight away, Jessie left her room at the Willard in the wrinkled dress she had worn during her sweltering trip. As she later reported, when the president came into the room, he bowed slightly, but did not speak. Nor did he offer her a seat. She handed him her husband's letter, which he read standing. To Lincoln's fury and dismay, Fremont had refused his private request to modify the proclamation, insisting that the president must publicly order him to do so. "If I were to retract of my own accord," the general argued, "it would imply that I myself thought it wrong, and that I had acted without the reflection which the gravity of the point demanded. But I did not do so." When Lincoln remarked that Fremont clearly knew what was expected of him, Jesse implied that Lincoln did not understand the complex situation in Missouri. Nor did he appreciate that unless the war became one of emancipation, European powers were more than likely to recognize the Confederacy. "You are quite a female politician," Lincoln remarked. He later recalled that Jesse Fremont had taxed me so violently with many things that I had to exercise all the awkward tact I have to avoid quarreling with her. She more than once intimated that if General Fremont should conclude to try conclusions with me, he could set up for himself. As Jessie left, she asked Lincoln when she might return to receive his reply. He told her he would send for her when he was ready. The next morning, Lincoln wrote his reply. This time he issued an open order to Fremont to revise his proclamation to conform to the provisions of the Confiscation Act. Rather than allow Jesse to hand-deliver it, he sent it to be mailed. in keeping with Fremont's own tactics, he made the reply public before Fremont would receive it. While Jesse waited vainly at the Willard for word from Lincoln, Francis Blair Sr. visited her room. "He had always been fond of me," Jesse recalled. "I had been like a child in their family, but Mr. Blair was now very angry. He told her that she and her husband had made a great mistake in incurring the enmity of the president. Talking too freely over a two-hour period, the elder Blair revealed that Frank had sent a letter to Monty describing the situation in Missouri, and that the president had sent Monty to St. Louis to examine into that department." Jesse was infuriated, assuming that Frank's letter had precipitated the investigation. She threatened the old man that Fremont should hold Frank personally responsible, expecting that she could make him quail at the thought of losing the son of whom he is most proud in a duel with a skilled duelist. Blair Sr. told her that the Blairs did not shrink from responsibility. Frank's sister, Lizzie, who, like the rest of the family, adored her high-spirited brother, believed her father had been most incautious in discussing Frank's letter with Jesse, rightly fearing that the Fremonts would retaliate. Meanwhile, Meggs and Monty Blair had assessed affairs in Missouri and were heading home. Meggs had come to the clear conclusion that Fremont was not fit to command the Department of the West. "The rebels are killing and ravaging the Union men throughout the state," he wrote. "Great distress and alarm prevail. In St. Louis, the leading people of the state complain that they cannot see him. He does not encourage the men to form regiments for defense." Monty Blair agreed. After what he described to Lincoln as a full and plain talk with Fremont, he claimed that the general "seems stupefied and almost unconscious and is doing absolutely nothing." Rumors circulated that Fremont was an opium eater. "No time is to be lost, and no man's feelings should be consulted," Blair concluded. The day after Monty Blair and Meggs departed for Washington, Fremont imprisoned Frank Blair, claiming that the letter he had written his brother on September 1st was an act of insubordination. By criticizing his commanding officer, with a view of effecting his removal, Frank was guilty of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. Fremont and Jesse had concluded that the Blairs had betrayed them. Monty interceded, writing a conciliatory letter to Fremont that led to Frank's release from jail. Frank insisted on fighting the charges, however, and was soon arrested again. Opinion in Missouri was equally divided between Frank Blair and General Fremont, each intent on destroying the other. General Scott had finally stepped in, ordering a suspension of Frank's arrest and postponing the trial, which would never take place. But the quarrel between the two old allies would have serious consequences in the years ahead. Lincoln's public abrogation of Fremont's proclamation produced a sigh of relief in the border states, but, as Lincoln had apprehended, it profoundly disappointed radical Republicans and abolitionists. Only days earlier, Frances Seward had happily asked her sister, "Were you not pleased with Fremont's proclamation?" Now, Lincoln had once again dashed her hopes. In Chicago, Joseph Medill lamented that Lincoln's letter has cast a funeral gloom over our patriotic city. It comes upon us like a killing June frost, which destroys the coming harvest. It is a step backwards. Senator Ben Wade blamed Lincoln's poor white trash background for his revolting decision, while Frederick Douglass despaired, "Many blunders have been committed by the government at Washington during this war, but this, we think, is the largest of them all." While radicals hoping to make emancipation the war's focus rallied behind Fremont, his anti-slavery credentials could not compensate for his flagrant mismanagement of the Department of the West. On September 18th, Monty Blair and Meggs delivered their negative report to the cabinet. Still, Lincoln hesitated. the president, is determined to let Fremont have a chance to win the state of Missouri, the frustrated Postmaster General told Francis Blair Sr. Bates, too, was irritated by the president's lack of resolution. With much of his large family still in Missouri, Bates had followed the state's troubles closely. He had spoken against Fremont on numerous occasions in the cabinet, certain that Fremont was doing more damage to our cause than half a dozen of the ablest generals of the enemy can do. Having assured Unionist friends in his home state that Fremont's removal was imminent, Bates felt distressed and mortified by the president's inaction. Anxious about Missouri's troubles, and anguished by the illness of his wife, Julia, who had suffered a slight paralytic stroke, Bates uncharacteristically lashed out at Lincoln. "Immense mischief is caused by his lack of vim," he wrote his brother-in-law, the former governor of Missouri. "He has no will, no power to command. He makes nobody afraid of him. And hence, discipline is relaxed, and stupid inanity takes the place of action." Frank Blair was more scathing in his criticisms of Lincoln and his cabinet. "I think God has made up his mind to ruin this nation," he wrote his brother Monty. "The only way to save it is to kick that pack of old women who compose the cabinet into the sea. I never, since I was born, imagined that such a lot of poltroons and apes could be gathered together from the four quarters of the globe as old Abe has succeeded in bringing together in his cabinet." His anger was focused on Seward and Cameron, and indirectly, of course, on Lincoln himself. In fact, Lincoln had already dispatched Secretary of War Simon Cameron, accompanied by Adjutant General Lorenzo Thomas, to St. Louis to examine the situation once more and deliver, at his discretion, a letter directing Fremont to surrender his command to the officer next below him. When Cameron arrived in St. Louis, he talked with Brigadier General Samuel R. Curtis, who spoke very freely of Fremont's qualities and conduct, and warned the Secretary of War that Missouri's safety could be guaranteed only by the termination of Fremont's command. Upon receiving the letter of dismissal, Fremont was very much mortified. He told Cameron that he was now in pursuit of the enemy, whom he believed were now within his reach, and that to recall him at this moment would not only destroy him, but render his whole expenditure useless. Cameron was swayed to withhold the order until he returned to Washington and talked with the president. By this point, Lincoln had little doubt that Fremont should be discharged. In addition to the impressions of Meigs, Monty Blair, and Cameron, he had received a blistering report from Adjutant General Thomas, detailing the sorry constitution of Fremont's army, its defective equipment and arming, its confusion and imbecility, its lack of transportation, a catalogue of items leading to the unassailable conclusion that its head is wholly incompetent and unsafe to be instructed with its management. Yet Lincoln still yielded to delay, Bates angrily confided in his diary, holding Seward responsible when the president hesitated a few days longer. "The president still hangs in painful and mortifying doubt," Bates wrote, "and if we persist in this sort of impotent indecision, we are very likely to share his fate, and, worse than all, deserve it." The Attorney General's impatience was understandable, but Lincoln's reasoning behind the delay was far shrewder than Bates realized. 2 days after Bates made his angry entry, Lincoln dispatched his friend Leonard Swett to hand-carry a removal order to Fremont. Before Swett reached St. Louis, however, the War Department released the damning report of Adjutant General Thomas to the press. Published on October 31st, the detailed report was considered by the New York Times the most remarkable document that has seen the light since the beginning of the present war. So damning were the revelations about Fremont, the Times continued, that it was mystifying why the Lincoln administration had allowed their publication. In fact, the decision to publicize the report was both calculated and canny. By the time the message was delivered to Fremont, the public had been primed with powerful arguments for his dismissal. Had Lincoln acted earlier, people might have concluded that Fremont was sacrificed to the Blairs, or, worse still, cashiered because of his proclamation emancipating the slaves. By leaking the facts in the report, Lincoln had adroitly prepared public opinion to support his decision. When Swett reached Missouri, he wisely anticipated that Fremont would suspect his mission and refuse him entry into camp. So he gave the dismissal order to an army captain who disguised himself as a farmer. With the document sewed into the lining of his coat, the messenger reached Fremont in person shortly after dawn on November 1st, the same day that General Scott's resignation was announced. When Fremont opened the order, the captain recalled, a frown came over his brow, and he slammed the paper down on the table and exclaimed, "Sir, how did you get admission into my lines?" By November 2nd, when the news was made public, the general reaction was that Lincoln was justified in his decision. Fremont no longer had apologists or defenders in Washington, the correspondent for the New York Times wrote. The evidences of his unfitness for command have naturally so accumulated here, the headquarters of the army, that no defense of him is possible. The Philadelphia Inquirer agreed. Slowly and reluctantly, we are forced to the conviction that General Fremont is unequal to the command of the Western Army. The report of Adjutant General Thomas, which we publish this morning, settles the question, in our judgment. In an unusually pro-administration editorial, the Democratic New York Herald noted with approval that while Lincoln is not the man to deal unjustly or ungenerously with any public officer, his firing of Fremont had become a public necessity to which the president could no longer shut his eyes. And this tells the whole story. Even Chase had to admit that Lincoln had handled the tangled situation admirably. "I am thoroughly persuaded," he wrote a friend, "that in all he has done concerning General F., the president has been guided by a true sense of public duty." 1 week after the resignation of General Scott and the dismissal of General Fremont, the administration faced a pressing new dilemma. Seward had received word that the Confederacy had dispatched two prominent Southerners, James Mason and John Slidell, to England to argue its case for formal recognition. Seward hoped to intercept the Confederate ship carrying the two former senators, but they had escaped the Union blockade in Charleston and reached Cuba, where they boarded the Trent, a British mail ship. On November 8th, Union Captain Charles Wilkes, in command of an armed sloop, encountered the Trent. Acting without official orders, he fired a shot across the bow and then proceeded to search the vessel. When Mason and Slidell were found, they were courteously escorted back to the Union sloop, San Jacinto, and taken to prison at Fort Warren in Boston. The British ship was allowed to continue its journey. Captain Wilkes became a national hero to a North desperate for good news. "We do not believe the American heart ever thrilled with more genuine delight than it did yesterday at the intelligence of the capture of Messrs. Slidell and Mason," the New York Times reported. "If we were to search the whole of rebeldom, no persons so justly obnoxious to the North could have been found." Wilkes was fêted at Faneuil Hall in Boston, and a great banquet was given in his honor. Cameron appeared before a throng of happy Washingtonians and led three cheers for Captain Wilkes. Bates recorded great and general satisfaction in his diary, while Chase reportedly said he regretted only that the captain had not gone one step further and seized the British ship. Lincoln, too, seemed pleased at first. In a letter to Edward Everett, he spoke happily of the items of news coming in last week, first the Union victory at Port Royal, and then the capture of Mason and Slidell. His gratification was soon mingled with anxiety, however, when Britain's furious reaction to the incident became known. It took nearly 3 weeks for news of Mason and Slidell's capture to reach London. But, as the Times reported, the intelligence spread with wonderful rapidity. The complex situation was promptly reduced to a slogan: "Outrage on the British flag. The Southern commissioners forcibly removed from a British mail steamer." The London press fulminated against the incident as an explicit violation of the law of nations, demanding reparation and apology. Fabricated details of the capture depicted a brutal removal of the Southern commissioners. Looking to give the supposed transgression a face, the British press focused upon Seward. Though the Secretary of State told British officials, confidentially, that Wilkes had acted without any instructions from the government, thereby sparing the government the embarrassment which might have resulted if the act had been specially directed by us, he decided not to speak publicly on the matter. The first public response should come from the British government, Seward maintained. Seward's silence troubled Thurlow Weed, whom Seward had sent to Europe as an unofficial representative. In one of his daily letters to Washington, Weed warned his oldest friend that if the taking of the rebels from under the protection of the British flag was intended and is avowed and maintained, it means war. Newspapers reported that steamers in every dockyard were being equipped with troops and supplies, ready to leave at the government's order. The press continued fanning the popular flame by promising to clear the sea of the American Navy in a month, acknowledge the Southern Confederacy, and by breaking the blockade, letting out cotton and letting in British manufactures. Secessionists in Europe, Weed reported, were certainly jubilant. Moreover, Weed anxiously wrote, words circulated in high places that Seward hoped to provoke a war with England for the purpose of getting Canada. Animosity toward Seward was widespread, he continued. How created or why, I know not. It has been skillfully worked. I was told yesterday repeatedly that I ought to write the President demanding your dismissal. Agitated by the vituperative attacks by the British press, Seward burst into Lincoln's office on Sunday afternoon, December 15th. Orville Browning, who was taking tea with the President at the time, dismissed Seward's worries, insisting that England would not do so foolish a thing as to declare war. Lincoln was not so sure. He recalled a ferocious bulldog in his hometown. While neighbors convinced themselves that they had nothing to fear, one wise man observed, "I know the bulldog will not bite. You know he will not bite. But does the bulldog know he will not bite?" The American press hounded Seward with questions about the affair, but both he and Lord Lyons, the British minister to Washington, remained silent as they awaited the official British response. On December 19th, nearly 6 weeks after the initial incident, Her Majesty's government finally declared the seizure of the envoys from the British ship an affront to the national honor, which could be restored only if the prisoners were freed and returned to British protection. In addition, Britain demanded a suitable apology for the aggression. If the United States did not agree within a few days, Lyons and the entire British delegation were to pack up and return to Britain. Lyons carried the document to the Secretary of State's office, where he discussed the inflamed situation with Seward. Before presenting the document formally, he agreed to leave a copy so that the Secretary and the President might have more time to consider their response. "You will perhaps be surprised to find Mr. Seward on the side of peace," Lord Lyons wrote to the British Foreign Minister. Fred Seward recalled that his father shut himself off from all visitors and devoted one entire day to drafting a reply. The astute secretary understood the dilemma perfectly. As a practical matter, the United States could not afford to go to war with Britain. With England as an auxiliary to rebellion, Weed had forewarned, we are crushed out. It was necessary that the government release the prisoners and allow them to continue their journey to England. Yet, overwhelming popular support in the North for the seizure of the rebels had to be taken into consideration. They can never be given up, one newspaper protested. The country would never forgive any man who should propose such a surrender. Lincoln himself, though resolved to avoid war with England, was reportedly unhappy about submitting to the British demands, which many considered humiliating. Seward composed an ingenious response, arguing that while Captain Wilkes had acted lawfully in searching the Trent, the legality of seizing contraband prisoners should have been decided by an American prize court. He recognized, he wrote, that he appeared to be taking the British side of the dispute against my own country, but he was really defending and maintaining not an exclusively British interest, but an old, honored, and cherished American cause. The principle of referring such disputes to a legal tribunal, he reminded Britain, had been established nearly 6 decades earlier by Secretary of State James Madison, when Britain had seized contraband from American ships in similar fashion. To deny the justice of the present British claim would be to reverse and forever abandon the very rationale upon which the United States had proudly stood in those earlier disputes. Therefore, in defense of principles confessedly American, the government would cheerfully free the prisoners and turn them over to Lord Lyons. Seward presented his arguments in an extraordinary cabinet session on Christmas morning. The discussion continued for 4 hours. There was great reluctance on the part of some of the members of the cabinet, and even the president himself, to accept Seward's argument, Bates recorded. They feared the displeasure of our own people, lest they should accuse us of timidly truckling to the power of England. The prospect of returning the prisoners was gall and wormwood to Chase. Rather than consent to the liberation of these men, he wrote, I would sacrifice everything I possess. Only Monty Blair, the consummate realist, stood firmly with Seward at the start. At Lincoln's invitation, Charles Sumner joined the session. As chairman of the Committee on Foreign Relations, he had conferred with Lincoln frequently during the crisis, asserting that the government should not risk war with England. Sumner had read letters from 2 respected London officials, to Lincoln and Seward, revealing that Britain did not want war, and that if the present dispute were settled amicably, Britain would not interfere further in the North's problems. The presentations by Seward and Sumner gained some support. But the cabinet, unable to reach a conclusion, decided to meet again the following day to hear Seward present a new draft. As the meeting adjourned, Lincoln turned to his Secretary of State. Governor Seward, you will go on, of course, preparing your answer, which, as I understand it, will state the reasons why they, the prisoners, ought to be given up. Now I have a mind to try my hand at stating the reasons why they ought not to be given up. We will compare the points on each side. Seward finished his 26-page dispatch that night and read it to Chase at his house the next morning before the cabinet convened. After brooding through the night, Chase had concluded that Seward was right. I am consoled by the reflection that while nothing but severest retribution is due to them, the surrender, under existing circumstances, is but simply doing right, he recorded in his diary. When the cabinet met the following day, Seward presented his final draft. Though disturbed by the prospect of surrendering the prisoners, the members were relieved that no apology had been rendered, and, as Seward boasted, a great point was gained for our government. The dispatch was unanimously adopted. After the meeting, Seward asked Lincoln why he had not presented an argument for the other side. With a smile, Lincoln replied, I found I could not make an argument that would satisfy my own mind, and that proved to me your ground was the right one. The following night, Seward hosted a dinner party, to which he invited Senators Crittenden and Conkling and their wives, Orville Browning, Charles Sumner, Preston King, and English novelist Anthony Trollope, whom Fanny described as a great, homely, red, stupid-faced Englishman with a disgusting beard of iron gray. The conversation at dinner was lively and contentious. Kentucky's Crittenden became enraged when Seward pronounced John Brown a hero. Fanny was upset when Crittenden criticized Florence Nightingale, the celebrated British nurse of the Crimean War, saying, "He thought it a very unwomanly thing for a gentle lady to go into a hospital of wounded men." Fanny saved her retort for her diary. "That was enough of you, Mr. C. If I hadn't seen you at the table, turn your head and spit on the floor-cloth." After dinner, Seward took the men into the cloakroom, where he read his Trent dispatch. The listeners generally commended Seward's handling of the crisis, though at the end of the reading, Crittenden swore vehemently. Everyone assumed the public would be infuriated by the decision, and that the publication of the dispatch would doom Seward to unpopularity. In the end, the public greeted the dispatch with relief, not anger. Compared to the prospect of fighting both a civil war and a foreign war at the same time, the release of the two prisoners seemed inconsequential. "The general acquiescence in this concession is a good sign," George Templeton Strong observed. "It looks like willingness to pass over affronts that touch the democracy in its tenderest point, for the sake of concentrating all our national energies on the trampling out of domestic treason." Lincoln himself finally recognized both the diplomatic logic and the absolute necessity of giving up the prisoners. And he was willing to admit that, in this case, his Secretary of State had pursued the right course all along, a characteristic response that Fred Seward fully appreciated. "Presidents and kings are not apt to see flaws in their own arguments," he wrote. "But fortunately for the Union, it had a president at this critical juncture who combined a logical intellect with an unselfish heart." With the return of Congress for the winter session, the pace of social life in Washington quickened. Houses are being fitted for winter gaieties, rich dresses and laughing faces pass on every side, reported Iowa State Register columnist Mrs. Kara Kaysen, wife of the Assistant Postmaster General, who wrote under the pseudonym of Miriam. "The city is thronged with strangers. Every nook and corner is occupied with lookers-on at this swiftly moving panorama of life in the Capitol." The crowds who streamed into the White House receptions that winter found a mansion transformed by Mary Lincoln's tireless efforts. Peeling walls had been stripped and covered with elegant Parisian wallpaper. New sets of china adorned the tables. Magnificent new rugs replaced their threadbare predecessors. Even one of Mary's severest critics, Mary Clemmer Ames, grudgingly admitted that the new rugs were magnificent. She considered the velvet one in the East Room the most exquisite carpet ever to cover the historic floor. Its ground was of pale sea green, and in effect looked as if the ocean, in gleaming and transparent waves, were tossing roses at your feet. A California journalist praised the finished product highly. "The president's house has once more assumed the appearance of comfort and comparative beauty." The historian George Bancroft reported favorably to his wife about a visit with the First Lady, who was able with equal charm to discuss her plans for the elegant fitting up of Mr. Lincoln's room and to discourse eloquently on a recent military review. Bancroft came home entranced. "Mary is better in manners and in spirit than we have generally heard, is friendly and not in the least arrogant." As the bills came in, however, Mary discovered that she had overspent the $20,000 allowance by more than $6,800. Afraid to inform her husband, she inveigled John Watt, the White House groundskeeper, to inflate his expense accounts and funnel the extra money over to her. She had replaced her first commissioner of public buildings after he refused to pay for an elaborate White House dinner from the manure account. She exchanged her patronage influence for reduced bills and accepted gifts from wealthy donors. At one point, she asked John Hay to turn over the White House stationery fund for her use, and later to pay her as the White House steward. "I told her to kiss mine," Hay jokingly informed Nicolay. "Was I right?" Mary was irate when Hay denied her requests. She tried to have him fired, forever losing his goodwill. "The devil is abroad, having great wrath," he confided to Nicolay. "His daughter, the Hellcat, is in a state of mind about the steward's salary." Despite her finagling, Mary found herself in trouble shortly before the new year when more bills arrived with no money left in the account. She had no recourse but to tell her husband what had happened and to beg him to ask for an additional appropriation. To bolster her case, she asked Benjamin French, the new commissioner of public buildings, to speak with her husband. French caught up with the president shortly after he returned home from a memorial service in the Senate for Edward Baker. The juxtaposition between the moving eulogies for his old friend and the unpleasant topic of decorating bills provoked in Lincoln an unusual display of anger. The president was inexorable, French recalled. He said it would stink in the land to have it said that an appropriation of $20,000 for furnishing the house had been overrun by the president when the poor freezing soldiers could not have blankets, and he swore he would never approve the bills for flubdubs for that damned old house. Moreover, Lincoln angrily pointed out, the place was furnished well enough when they came, better than any house they had ever lived in, and rather than put his name to such a bill, he would pay it out of his own pocket. French was nonetheless determined to aid Mary's cause. "He liked her better and better the more I see of her," he admitted, "and think she is an admirable woman. She bears herself in every particular like a lady, and say what they may about her, I will defend her." He succeeded in convincing a friendly congressman to hide a deficiency appropriation in a complex list of military appropriations. The crisis was resolved, at least temporarily, until Mary's continued spending produced another round of bills. Mary was not alone in her worries about money. In the fall of 1861, Kate spent several weeks in Philadelphia and New York on a mission to purchase new furnishings for her father's mansion. Merchants gladly extended lines of credit for Kate, as they had for Mary, creating great anxiety in her father's mind. "I need hardly caution you to avoid extravagance, as it is going to be hard work to make both ends meet here, and if any circumstances should compel me to resign, before long my expenses shall have far exceeded my income. It does seem a little hard that one who has so much and such important work to do as I have had for the past 12 years should all the time have to pay such a large part of his own expenses." The sense of injustice Chase felt in having to bear the burdens of public life lured him into a questionable relationship with a wealthy Philadelphia banker, Jay Cook, who had been granted a lucrative contract from the Treasury Department for the sale of government bonds. Perceiving both Chase's financial strain and his aggrieved pride, Cook began to send valuable gifts to the Chase household, including an elegant open carriage for Kate and a set of bookcases for the parlor. As the relationship warmed, Chase borrowed money from Cook, and eventually Cook took it upon himself to set up his own investment account for Chase. "I will take great pains to lay aside occasionally some choice tidbits managing the investments for you and not bothering your head with them." If all went well, Cook hoped, the profit earned would make up the deficiency between Chase's salary and his expenses, for it is a shame that you should go behindhand working as you do. In the smooth Philadelphia banker, the Chases had found what Mary Lincoln unsuccessfully sought, a reliable source to fund the high cost of being a leader of society in wartime Washington. By the end of 1861, Lincoln realized that he had made a serious mistake in placing Simon Cameron at the head of the War Department. For many decades, Cameron had maintained his power base in Pennsylvania through the skillful use of patronage to reward loyalists and punish opponents. Unfortunately, the expertise of a wily political boss proved inadequate to the tremendous administrative challenge of leading the War Department in the midst of a civil war. A central system of civilian command was essential to construct a machine capable of providing strategy, supplies, logistics, and training for an army that had grown from 16,000 in March to 670,000 in December. Careful record-keeping was indispensable when contracts worth millions had to be negotiated for rifles, cannons, horses, uniforms, food, and blankets. As Lincoln confided to Nicolay, Cameron was incapable either of organizing details or conceiving and advising general plans. His primitive filing system consisted mainly of scribbled notes. According to Ohio Congressman Albert Riddle, when Cameron was asked about the progress of a particular matter, he would look about, find a scrap of paper, borrow your pencil, make a note, put the paper in one pocket of his trousers and your pencil in the other. The war was less than 2 months old when detailed accusations of corruption and inefficiency in the War Department began to surface in newspapers. In July, the Congress appointed a committee to investigate charges that middlemen had made off with scandalous profits on contracts for unworkable pistols and carbines, blind horses, and knapsacks that disintegrated when it rained. Though Cameron was not charged with pocketing the money himself, several of his political cronies had grown rich. Vast public funds had been wasted, and the lives of Union soldiers had been jeopardized. As the charges multiplied, Republican newspapers began to call for his resignation, lest the entire administration become tainted by the scandal. "It is better to lose a mortified finger of the right hand at once," the New York Times declared, "than to cherish it till the arm is full of disease and the whole system threatened with dissolution." Determined to protect his position, Cameron sought to ingratiate himself with the increasingly powerful radical Republicans in Congress, led by Massachusetts's Charles Sumner, Ohio's Ben Wade, Indiana's George Julian, and Maine's William Fessenden. Though known as a conservative on the issue of slavery, Cameron began by degrees to embrace the radicals' contention that the central purpose of the war was to bring the institution of human bondage to an end. While he allied himself initially with Seward, Cameron turned increasingly to Chase, the single cabinet member at the time not only in favor of allowing fugitive slaves to stay within Union lines, but also of enlisting and arming them. "We agreed," Chase later recalled, "that the necessity of arming them was inevitable. But we were alone in that opinion." Acting without Lincoln's approval, Cameron publicly endorsed the position of an army colonel who had sanctioned seizing slaves and using them for military service as one step in a more general policy of deploying extremist measures against the rebels, even to their absolute ruin. In cabinet sessions and at private dinners, he instigated heated arguments with Bates, Blair, and Smith, who fiercely assailed his position. Cameron maintained that black soldiers would add an essential weapon in the quest for victory. Blair claimed that Cameron was riding the nigger hobby for his own political advantage. The situation came to a head in early December. Each department customarily presented an annual report to the president as he prepared his own yearly message. While drafting the War Department report, the War Secretary resolved to officially advocate arming slaves who came into Union lines. Well aware that he would ignite controversy, Cameron read his draft to a series of friends, most of whom urged him to keep silent on the contentious issue. At this point, Cameron recalled, I sought out another counselor, one of broad views, great courage, and of tremendous earnestness. It was Edwin Stanton. Cameron had called on Stanton during the summer and fall for legal advice on various contracts. This matter, however, was more delicate. Stanton read the report carefully, according to Cameron, and gave it his unequivocal and hearty support. In fact, he suggested his own provocative logic, which served to strengthen the argument for arming slaves. It is clearly a right of the government to arm slaves when it may become necessary, the addition read, as it is to take gunpowder from the enemy. It remains unclear whether Stanton offered his deliberately incendiary advice to encourage the War Secretary openly to defy Lincoln, hoping that if Cameron were dismissed, he, Stanton, might be called upon to replace him. Perhaps he was an abolitionist at heart, simply waiting for the right moment to reveal his honest convictions. He had, after all, given his boyhood pledge to his father that he would fight slavery until the end of his life, and had expressed similar sentiments to Chase in the bloom of their friendship in Ohio. More significant, Charles Sumner considered Stanton my personal friend, who goes as far as I do in directing the war against slavery. Yet when Stanton talked with fellow Democrats during this same period of time, including McClellan and his former cabinet colleague Jeremiah Black, he expressed decidedly more conservative views on the issue of slavery. Whatever Stanton's purpose, his approval emboldened Cameron, who sent out advance copies of his report to a number of newspapers before submitting it to the president. When the government printer brought the War Department report to the president for approval, Lincoln discovered the inflammatory paragraph. "This will never do," he said. "General Cameron must take no such responsibility. That is a question which belongs exclusively to me." He deleted the paragraph and issued orders to seize every copy already sent. While Lincoln understood that the slaves coming into Union hands must be provided for in some way, he did not believe, he later wrote, that he possessed the constitutional authority to liberate and arm them. The only way that such actions, otherwise unconstitutional, might become lawful, was if those measures were deemed indispensable for the preservation of the nation, and, therefore, for the preservation of the Constitution itself. At this juncture, he was not convinced that arming seized slaves was an indispensable necessity. Moreover, he was undeniably aware that such a measure at this time would alienate the moderate majority of his coalition. Lincoln informed Cameron of his action at the next cabinet meeting, emphasizing, as he had with Fremont, that any decision regarding the future of slavery rested with the president, not with a subordinate official. Although Cameron immediately conceded and agreed to delete the vetoed language, he complained that his excised recommendation was no different from the suggestion Wells had made in his annual report. This was the moment that Wells dreaded most, his biographer observed. Like the Secretary of War, the Secretary of the Navy had felt compelled to make some provision for fugitive slaves who have sought our ships for refuge and protection. In such cases, Wells declared, the slaves should be cared for and employed by either the Navy or the Army, depending on which branch had greater need, and If no employment could be found for them in the public service, they should be allowed to proceed freely and peaceably, without restraint, to seek a livelihood. Certain that he, too, would be commanded to revise his report, Wells resolved that he would resign before doing so. But to his bewilderment, Lincoln allowed the Navy report to be printed without change. Shrewdly, Lincoln had recognized at once the political difference between the two situations. The Army occupied territory in the border states, while the Navy did not, allowing blacks to find employment on naval ships or in surrounding harbors on the coast, was fundamentally different from providing weapons to blacks in the slave states of Kentucky or Missouri, whose continued loyalty was critical to the Union. Lincoln still believed that such a step would drive the loyal citizens of these states into the Confederacy. In fact, the President had developed his own policy for the increasing numbers of fugitive slaves who had come into Union lines. As members of Congress gathered on Capitol Hill for the opening of the winter session, he outlined his ideas in his annual message. He recognized, he wrote, that under the Confiscation Act, when Union armies secured territory where slaves had been used by their masters for insurrectionary purposes, the legal rights of the slaveholders were forfeited. Slaves thus liberated had to be provided for in some way. He was hopeful that some of the loyal border states might soon pass similar enactments. If such actions were taken, Lincoln recommended that the Congress compensate the states for each freed slave. Lincoln still believed that both classes of freed slaves should be colonized on a purely voluntary basis, at some place or places in a climate congenial to them. It might be well to consider, too, whether the free colored people already in the United States could not, so far as individuals may desire, be included in such colonization. So long as Lincoln remained hopeful that the Union could be restored, before the conflict degenerated into a violent and remorseless revolutionary struggle, he was unwilling, he said, to sanction radical and extreme measures regarding slavery. Despite this assertion, he closed his message with a graceful and irrefutable argument against the continuation of slavery in a democratic society, the very essence of which opened the way to all, granted hope to all, and advanced the condition of all. In this just and generous and prosperous system, he reasoned, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Then, reflecting upon the vicissitudes of his own experience, Lincoln added, "The prudent, penniless beginner in the world labors for wages a while, saves a surplus with which to buy tools or land for himself, then labors on his own account another while, and at length hires another new beginner to help him." Clearly, this upward mobility, the possibility of self-realization so central to the idea of America, was closed to the slave unless and until he became a free man. Abolitionists condemned Lincoln's message. "Away with the unstatesmanlike scheme of colonization, thrust so unfortunately into the face of the nation at this juncture," the abolitionist Worthington G. Snethen wrote Chase. "Let the sword make a nation of 4 millions of black men free, and let them be free as the white man." Frederick Douglass was so outraged, both by the idea of colonizing freed slaves and by the president's refusal to enlist blacks into the army, that he was close to losing all faith in Lincoln. The president did not understand that the black man was an American, with no desire to live elsewhere. "His attachment to the place of his birth is stronger than iron." Moreover, why such fearful concern about the destiny of the freed slave? "Give him wages for his work, and let hunger pinch him if he don't work," Douglass declared. "He is used to work and is not afraid of it. His hands are already hardened by toil, and he has no dreams of ever getting a living by any other means than by hard work. Since the beginning of the war, Douglas had avowed that nothing would terrify the South like the vision of thousands of former slaves wielding weapons on behalf of the Union Army. One black regiment alone would be in such a war the full equal of two white ones. The very fact of color, in this case, would be more terrible than powder and balls. Predicting that a lenient war would be a lengthy war and therefore the worst kind of war, Douglas contended that the survival of the nation depended upon enlisting the slaves and free colored people into the army. In a speech in Philadelphia, he proclaimed, "We are striking the guilty rebels with our soft white hand, when we should be striking with the iron hand of the black man, which we keep chained behind us. We have been catching slaves instead of arming them. We pay more attention to the advice of the half-rebel state of Kentucky than to any suggestion coming from the loyal North." While the radical press criticized Lincoln's message, moderate and conservative Republicans lauded his tact. "It appeals to the judgment, the solid convictions of the people, rather than their resentments or their impatient hopes and aspirations," the New York Times concluded. "And as the moderate men compose 9/10 of the population of the country, the message will doubtless meet with popularity." Even the normally critical New York Tribune conceded that "the country and the world will not fail to mark the contrast between the magnanimity of Lincoln's message and a recent truculent address by Jefferson Davis." Though Davis was commonly presumed the abler of the two statesmen, and certainly the better grammarian, the Tribune observed, the address of the Confederate chief was boastful, defiant, and savage, whereas Lincoln breathes not an unkind impulse and deals in no railing accusations. Chapter 15. My Boy is Gone. The Lincolns hosted the traditional New Year's Day reception to mark the advent of 1862. The day was unusually beautiful, the New York Times reported, the sky being clear and bright, and the air soft and balmy, more like May than January. Frances Seward, who had joined her husband for the holidays, found the festive atmosphere reassuring. "For the first time since we have been here," she told her sister, "the carriages are rolling along the streets as they used to do in old times." Bates, too, was braced by the glorious day. "All the world was out," he noted. Thousands of citizens streamed into the White House when the gates were opened at noon. The Marine Band played as members of the public shook hands with the President and First Lady. They mingled with Supreme Court justices, senators, congressmen, foreign ministers, military officers, and cabinet officials. At long last, Fanny met the First Lady, whom she described as a compact little woman with a full round face, wearing a black silk or brocade with purple clusters in it, and some appropriate velvet head arrangement. Though Lincoln cordially greeted every guest, he was under great pressure. In the 9th month of the war, tales of corruption and mismanagement in the War Department combined with lack of progress on the battlefield to prevent Chase from raising the funds the Treasury needed to keep the war effort afloat. As public impatience mounted, Lincoln feared that the bottom was out of the tub. While the disgruntled public might focus on various members of the military and the cabinet, the president knew that he would ultimately be held responsible for the choices of his administration. "If the new year shall be only the continuation of the faults, the mistakes, and the incapacities prevailing during 1861, diarist Count Gorofsky warned, "then the worst is to be expected." Lincoln had been so reticent during the summer and fall, when Cameron was first criticized for his lax administration and questionable contracts, that Seward questioned whether the president was sufficiently attentive to the unsavory situation. Then, one night in January, the Secretary of State recalled, there was a ring at my doorbell. The president entered, seated himself on the sofa, and abruptly commenced talking about the condition of the War Department. He soon made it apparent that he had all along observed and known as much about it as any of us. His mind was now settled, and he had come to consult me about a successor to Mr. Cameron. Choosing the right successor to Cameron was vital. Lincoln's initial preferences may have included Joseph Holt, Buchanan's war secretary, who had crucially supported the Union during the secession crisis, or West Point graduate Montgomery Blair. According to Wells, Blair had exhibited great intelligence, knowledge of military men, sagacity, and sound judgment during cabinet discussions. Instead of either man, in a decision that would prove most significant to the course of the war, Lincoln selected Edwin Stanton, the gruff lawyer who had humiliated him in Cincinnati 6 years earlier, and whose disparaging remarks about his presidency were well known in Washington circles. Washington insiders attributed the choice to the combined influence of Seward and Chase. These two rivals rarely agreed on policy or principle, but each had his own reason for advocating Stanton. Seward would never forget Stanton's contribution as his informant during the last weeks of the Buchanan tenure. The intelligence provided by Stanton had helped root out traitors and keep Washington safe from capture. It had also fortified Seward's role as the central figure in the critical juncture between Lincoln's election and inauguration. Chase's far more intimate friendship with Stanton had grown from their earlier days in Ohio, when Stanton had assured Chase that, "To be loved by you and be told that you value my love is a gratification beyond my power to express." Equally important, Chase believed that Stanton would be a steadfast ally in the struggle against slavery. Lincoln had his own recollections of Stanton, not all of which were negative. He had watched Stanton at work on the Reaper trial, and had been impressed instantly by the powerful reasoning of Stanton's arguments, the passion of his delivery, and the unparalleled energy he had devoted to the case. "He puts his whole soul into any cause he espouses," one observer noted. "If you ever saw Stanton before a jury, you would see that he toils for his client with as much industry as if his case was his own, as if his own life depended upon the issue." Energy and force were desperately needed to galvanize the War Department, and Stanton had both in abundance. On Saturday, January 11th, the president sent an uncharacteristically brusque letter to Cameron, in light of the fact that the War Secretary had previously expressed a desire for a change of position. He wrote, "I can now gratify you, consistently with my view of the public interest, by nominating you to the Senate next Monday as Minister to Russia." After receiving the dismissal letter on Sunday, Cameron is said to have wept. "This is not a political affair," he insisted. "It means personal degradation." After dinner that night, Cameron went to see Chase. They apparently talked over the troubled situation and decided to enlist Seward's help. Chase drove Cameron back to Willard's and then went alone to Seward's house. As planned, Cameron came in soon after, brandishing the president's letter, which, he said, was intended as a dismissal and therefore discourteous. Cameron was finally convinced to retain the letter till morning and then go and see the president. Later that night, Chase confided in his diary, "I fear Mr. Seward may think Cameron's coming into his house prearranged, and that I was not dealing frankly." As usual, however, so long as the high-minded Chase was certain that he had acted right and with just deference to all concerned, he was able to rationalize his machinations. The next day, presumably briefed by Seward and Chase, Lincoln agreed to withdraw his terse letter and substitute a warm note indicating that Cameron had initiated the departure. Since the desirable post at St. Petersburg was vacant, the president would happily gratify Cameron's desire. Should you accept it, you will bear with you the assurance of my undiminished confidence, of my affectionate esteem, and of my sure expectation that you will be able to render services to your country not less important than those you could render at home. He also asked Cameron to recommend a successor. Cameron expressed his fervent opinion that his fellow Pennsylvanian, Stanton, was the best man for the job. In fact, Lincoln had already made his decision, but Cameron left, believing he was responsible for Stanton's selection. In the end, each of the three men, Seward, Chase, and Cameron, assumed he was instrumental in Lincoln's appointment of the new Secretary of War. After settling matters with Cameron, Lincoln asked George Harding, whom he had made head of the Patent Office, to bring his old law partner Stanton to the White House. Stanton was then 47, though the grizzled brown hair and beard made him look older, as did the glasses that hid his bright brown eyes. Harding was afraid that disagreeable recollections from the Reaper trial would cast a pall on the meeting. Both Lincoln and Stanton seemed to have put the past behind them, however, leaving Harding the most embarrassed of the three. The urgency of the situation left Stanton little time to deliberate. He consulted his wife, Ellen, who, according to her mother, objected to his acceptance. The move to the War Department would substantially diminish the lifestyle of the Stanton family, slashing a legal income of over $50,000 a year to $8,000. Stanton, too, tormented all his life by fears of insolvency, must have been concerned about the drastic diminution of income. Nevertheless, he could not refuse to serve as Secretary of War in the midst of a great civil war. And if he served with distinction, his life, however short in years, might be made long by noble deeds, as Chase had once prophesied. He accepted the post on the condition that he could retain Peter Watson, his old friend and assistant on the Reaper trial, to take care of the contracts, for he realized he would be swamped at once without Watson's aid. The announcement of Cameron's resignation and Stanton's appointment took the majority of the cabinet by surprise. "Strange," Bates confided in his diary, "that not a hint of all this was discussed at the cabinet council the previous Friday, and stranger still, the president had sent for no one but Seward over the weekend. Wells heard the dramatic news from Monty Blair, whom he met on the street. Neither one of them, Wells confessed, had been taken into Lincoln's confidence. Indeed, Wells had never even met Stanton. Stanton's nomination dismayed radical Republicans on Capitol Hill. The powerful William Fessenden, fearful that Stanton's Democratic heritage would incline him toward a soft policy on both slavery and the South, worked to delay the Senate confirmation until he ascertained more about Stanton's position. He conferred with Chase, who assured Fessenden that he, Secretary Chase, was responsible for Mr. Stanton's selection, and that he would arrange a meeting that very evening between the main senator and Stanton. Seward's role in the selection was not publicized, allowing the radicals to assume that Chase, their man in the cabinet, was the chief architect of the appointment. After a lengthy conversation with Stanton, Fessenden told Chase that he was thoroughly convinced that Stanton was just the man we want. The senator was delighted to find that he and Buchanan's former attorney general concurred on every point, including the conduct of the war and the Negro question. The Senate confirmed Stanton's nomination the next day. News of Stanton's replacement for Cameron met with widespread approval. The public generally assumed that Cameron had retired voluntarily. "Not only was the press completely taken by surprise," Seward told his wife, "but with all its fertility of conjecture, not one newspaper has conceived the real cause." Cameron's reputation was preserved until the House Committee on Contracts published its 1,100-page report in February 1862, detailing the extensive corruption in the War Department that had led to the purchase of malfunctioning weapons, diseased horses, and rotten food. According to one newspaper report, the committee resolved to advise the immediate passage of a bill to punish with death any person who commits a fraud upon the government, whereby a soldier is bodily injured, as, for instance, in the sale of unsound provisions. Though Cameron was never charged with personal liability, the House voted to censure him for conduct highly injurious to the public service. Cameron was devastated, knowing that he would never recover from the scandal. Lincoln, however, made a great personal effort to assuage his pain and humiliation. He wrote a long public letter to Congress, explaining that the unfortunate contracts were spawned by the emergency situation facing the government in the immediate aftermath of Fort Sumter. Lincoln declared that he and his entire cabinet were at least equally responsible with Cameron for whatever error, wrong, or fault was committed. Cameron would never forget this generous act. Filled with gratitude and admiration, he would become, Nicolay and Hay observed, one of the most intimate and devoted of Lincoln's personal friends. He appreciated the courage it took for Lincoln to share the blame at a time when everyone else had deserted him. Most other men in Lincoln's situation, Cameron wrote, would have permitted an innocent man to suffer rather than incur responsibility. Lincoln was not like most other men, as each cabinet member, including the new war secretary, would soon come to understand. On his first day in office, the energetic, hard-working Stanton instituted an entirely new regime in the War Department. Cameron's department had been so inundated by office seekers and politicians that officials had little time to answer letters or file telegraphs they received. As a result, requests for military supplies were often delayed for weeks. Stanton decreed that letters and written communications will be attended to the first thing in the morning when they are received, and will have precedence over all other business. While Cameron had welcomed congressmen and senators every day but Sunday, Stanton announced that the War Department would be closed to all business unrelated to military matters from Tuesdays through Fridays. Congressmen and senators would be received on Saturdays, the general public on Mondays. Stanton quickly removed many of Cameron's people and surrounded himself with men much like himself, full of passion, devotion, and drive. He made it clear from the beginning that he would not tolerate unmerited requests for even the smallest job. The day after he took office, Stanton later recalled, he met with a man he instinctively judged to be one of those indescribable half-loafers, half-gentlemen, who carried with him a card from Mrs. Lincoln asking that the man be made a commissary. Stanton was furious. He ripped up the note and sent the man away. The very next day the man returned with an official request from Mary that he be given the appointment. Stanton did not budge, dismissing the job seeker once again. That afternoon Stanton called on Mrs. Lincoln. He told her that, in the midst of a great war for national existence, his first duty is to the people, and his next duty is to protect your husband's honor and your own. If he appointed unqualified men simply to return favors, it would strike at the very root of all confidence. Mary understood his argument completely. "Mr. Stanton, you are right," she told him, "and I will never ask you for anything again." True to her word, Stanton affirmed, she never did. Under Stanton's altered regime, the War Department opened early in the morning, and the gas lamps remained lit late into the night. As his carriage turned from Pennsylvania Avenue into 17th Street, one of his clerks recalled, the doorkeeper on watch would put his head inside and cry in a low warning tone, "The Secretary!" The word was passed along and around till the whole building was traversed by it, and for a minute or two there was a shuffling of feet and a noise of opening and shutting of doors as the stragglers and loungers everywhere fled to their stations. Stanton kept his meetings brief and pointed. He was fluent without wordiness, George Templeton Strong wrote, and above all, earnest, warm-hearted, and large-hearted. His tireless work style invigorated his colleagues. Persons at a distance, a correspondent in the capital city wrote, cannot well realize what a revolution has been wrought in Washington by the change of the head of the War Department. The very atmosphere of the city breathes of change. The streets, the hotels, the halls of Congress speak it. After nearly a year of disappointment with Cameron, Lincoln had found in Stanton the leader the War Department needed. Early in February 1862, Mary Lincoln pioneered a new form of entertainment at the White House. Instead of the traditional public receptions, which allowed anyone to walk in off the street, or the expensive state dinners, designed for only a small number, she sent out some 500 invitations for an evening ball to be held at the White House on February 5th. Since the party was not open to the public, an invitation became a mark of prestige in Washington society. Those who were not on the original list, according to Nicolay, sought and almost begged their invitations. Mary prepared for her gala with great enthusiasm. She arranged for the Marine Band to play in the corridor and brought in a famous New York catering firm to serve the midnight supper. She had her black seamstress, Elizabeth Keckley, create a beautiful white satin gown with black trimming, a long train, and a low-cut neckline that instantly attracted Lincoln's eye. He laughingly suggested that if some of that tail was nearer the head, it would be in better style. Meanwhile, Willie and Tad had settled into a happy routine. They worked with their tutor in the mornings and played with the two Taft boys in the afternoons and evenings, either at the White House or at the Taft home. Judge Taft became much attached to both Lincoln boys. He believed that Willie had more judgment and foresight than any boy of his age that he had ever known. The four boys built a cabin on the mansion's flat roof, which was protectively encircled by a high stone balustrade. They named their makeshift fortification the Ship of State and equipped it with a spyglass that enabled them to watch the movement of boats on the Potomac and troops on the shore. They invited guests to theatrical performances in the attic. Riding the pony given Willie as a gift became another favorite pastime. In mid-January, when Robert came home on vacation from Harvard College, the family was complete. Then, a few days before Mary's grand party, Willie came down with a fever. Illness had been prevalent in Washington that January, as snow was followed by sleet and rain that left the ground covered with a thick layer of foul-smelling mud. Smallpox and typhoid fever had taken many lives. "There is a good deal of alarm in the city on account of the prevalence of the smallpox," Judge Taft recorded in his diary. "There are cases of it in almost every street in the city." Illness had struck the Stantons, the Sewards, and the Chases. Stanton's youngest son, James, had become critically ill after a smallpox vaccination caused a dreadful eruption on all parts of the baby boy's body. The illness continued for 6 weeks, during which time he was not expected to live. In this same period, Fanny Seward, who had gone to Philadelphia with her mother, contracted what was first suspected to be smallpox, but was probably typhoid. Her burning fever, back pains, and ulcerated throat lasted for nearly 2 weeks. Seward left Washington in alarm to be with Fanny, one of the few departures from his work during the entire war. Nettie Chase was also seriously ill, having contracted scarlet fever on her way to boarding school in Pennsylvania. Mary thought it best to cancel the party because of Willie's illness, but Lincoln hesitated, since the invitations had already been sent out. he called in Dr. Robert Stone, who was considered the dean of the Washington medical community. After examining Willie, the renowned doctor concluded that the boy was in no immediate danger and that there was every reason for an early recovery. Relieved by the diagnosis, the Lincolns decided to hold the ball. The carriages began arriving at the brilliantly lit White House around 9 p.m. All the Washington elite were present, the cabinet members and their wives, generals and their high staff, the members of the diplomatic corps, senators and congressmen, lawyers and businessmen. McClellan, in dress uniform, attracted much attention, as did the new Secretary of War. The green, red, and blue parlors were open for inspection, along with the East Room, where the Lincolns received their guests. Society reporters commented on both the exquisite taste with which the White House has been refitted under Mrs. Lincoln's directions, and the magnificence of the women's attire. The violet-eyed Kate Chase was singled out, as usual. She wore a dress of mauve-colored silk, without ornament, one reporter wrote admiringly. On her small, classically shaped head, a simple wreath of minute white flowers mingled with the blonde waves of her sunny hair, which was arranged in a Grecian knot behind. At midnight, the crowd began to move toward the closed dining room. During a slight delay, occasioned by a steward who had temporarily misplaced the key, someone exclaimed, "I am in favor of a forward movement," and everyone laughed, including General McClellan. The doors were thrown open to reveal a sumptuous banquet, which was to be served with excellent wine and champagne. The brilliance of the scene could not dispel the sadness that rested upon the face of Mrs. Lincoln, Elizabeth Keckley, the seamstress who had become a close confidant, recalled. During the evening she came upstairs several times and stood by the bedside of the suffering boy. Despite Mary's worry and watchfulness, the ball was a triumph. "Those who were here," Nicolay told his fiancée, "will be forever happy in the recollection of the favor enjoyed, because their vanity has been tickled with the thought that they have attained something which others have not." Although there was some cavilling about frivolity, hilarity, and gluttony, while hundreds of sick and suffering soldiers were within plain sight, reviews in the capital city were overwhelmingly favorable. The Washington Evening Star pronounced the event a brilliant spectacle, while Leslie's illustrated newspaper described Mary as our fair Republican queen, garbed in a lustrous white satin robe and black and white headdress in perfect keeping with her regal style of beauty. The success of the White House ball was followed by two Union victories in Tennessee, the captures of Fort Henry on the Tennessee River and Fort Donelson on the Cumberland. These twin victories shifted the defensive struggle in the West to an offensive war and brought national recognition to a new hero, General Ulysses S. Grant. A West Point graduate whose weakness for alcohol had contributed to his resignation from the Army 8 years earlier, Grant was struggling to support his family as a leather salesman in Galena, Illinois, when the Civil War began. He volunteered to serve immediately and was put in charge of a regiment in Missouri. From the start, Grant understood that a southward movement from Missouri was essential, but he was unable to persuade General Henry Halleck, Fremont's successor, to authorize the move. Hearing rumors that the unkempt, bewhiskered Grant still drank too much, Halleck was unwilling to trust him with an important mission. Finally, on February 1st, after the Navy's Admiral Andrew Foote agreed to a joint Army-Navy expedition, Halleck gave the go-ahead for Grant to take and hold Fort Henry. Grant and Foote set out at once. The Navy gunboats opened a blistering attack, forcing the retreat of 2,500 rebel troops.